As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com. Stole it in the side, baby, diamond ring.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
It's Coolest Conversations podcast time, presented by Hard Rock, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. Today I'm chatting with music critic and author Joel Selvin about his new book, Hollywood Eden, Electric Guitars, Fast Cars, and the Myth of the California Paradise, which covers the rise of surf and hot rod music, as well as the beginnings of folk rock in Southern California, and how Los Angeles became the epicenter of the pop music world in the mid-60s. It's an amazing story that begins with the high school graduating class of 1958, University High School in Los Angeles. And that year's graduates included Jan Berry, Dean Torrance, Nancy Sinatra, Kim Fowley, Sandy Nelson, and Bruce Johnston, among others. They were all classmates together and on the cusp of making pop music history. It's a trip that takes us out to Surf City and beyond. And so to start off, we'll hitch a ride there with Jan and Dean, and then return with Joel Selvin for your Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage. This is the Mighty Manfred, and my guest for our Coolest Conversations is music critic and author Joel Selvin. His latest book, Hollywood Eden, Electric Guitars, Fast Cars, and the Myth of the California Paradise, is the reason we get to chat today. How are you, Joel?
Too much, baby. All right. All right. Good to be here. Mighty Manfred.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining me. You grew up in Berkeley, California. Do I have that right?
Grew up's a strong phrase for what I did. But yeah, I mean, that's where my parents raised me. Growing up took a lot longer.
Well, I want to know, does your, let's say, your music coming of age tie in with the late 60s rock scene there in the Bay Area? Or did it begin south of Berkeley in this Hollywood Eden?
I'm in that era where all the Beach Boys records on the radio, I heard when they were new. But I'm definitely a child of the San Francisco music scene. I danced at the Fillmore to the Grateful Dead under the influence of LSD. But I've never seen myself so provincially San Francisco as more Californian. And I've always loved and been fascinated by Southern California. It's an entirely different culture. We all know that.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of overlap in the Venn diagrams. And I speak Southern Californian, and, you know, it's always been one big great nation state to me.
Well, I really enjoy the book. Congratulations on finishing, getting it published. And one thing I enjoy outside of the stories, I really like how you structured it, going by year, talking about the various artists, what they were up to within that given time and how they related to one another. Was there ever an editor arguing otherwise to present like each artist as a separate chapter, or why did you structure it the way you did?
Well, the Hollywood Eden is written in sort of like a novel. And I mean, that's a conceit. I realize that's often promulgated with nonfiction, but it really was in my mind to develop the narrative like a story and introduce characters that were going to know each other and work with each other in much in the way like a Dickens novel starts. And it opens at high school in 1958, where a bunch of my people that were going to be in the book all knew each other and went to school together. You know, high school is a kind of unique American phenomenon. There's nothing like it elsewhere. And it, to me, it's a sort of keystone American experience. It's where it's not just about the education in the classrooms. It's about socializing. It's about politicizing. It's about sexualizing. So much of your growth as a human being and so much of your introduction to social means takes place in those 3 years. And you never forget it. And you never forget the people you went to school with. And all these guys, they burst out of University High in 1958, headed for the best-selling charts as rock and roll musicians. It's a fantastic moment in history. To me, one of the great times and places to have been a teenager in America.
We know we live in an era now where we hear this term privilege kind of bandied about. There's an aspect of that to these University High kids. You know, the world they exist is so bizarre compared to you know, what was average American then or even now still.
Anything but average. There's a very elevated social high school. It's a public high school, but it served the Bel Air and Brentwood neighborhoods, which were high-end West Los Angeles neighborhoods that were stocked with people in the movie business, not just actors and actresses, but lawyers, accountants, people who worked at the studios, and their children all went to school together at University High. So talk about privileged people. Jan Barry grew up in a house on the absolute top of the Bel Air Hills. I mean, they looked right down into a canyon where they would build the 405 freeway in the coming years. And his father was the right-hand man to Howard Hughes. Yeah, dad was in the Spruce Goose the one time Hughes took it up. Right. And he lived two blocks from Bruce Johnston, who would later join the Beach Boys. And Bruce was playing piano in Jan's garage back in the day. They used to go to school together, wait at the bus stop together. Now, Bruce's father was the head of a nationwide drugstore chain. You may remember him, Rexall Drugs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, these were the privileged elite of Southern California. And of course, so they were born with a sense of possibility. They didn't know anything wasn't possible. And that was part of what opened up to them these rock and roll dreams that they pursued is, you know, why shouldn't they do it? They could do anything.
And I think it too was important here with your story is the fact that Los Angeles at that time, and I think maybe hard for people to think of it like this, but at that time, LA is considered to be sort of backwater to the major record labels, the music industry overall. And that really helps play into the fact that with a bit of chutzpah and moxie, you know, these kids could have a music business career with hit records. Can you talk about that some?
Los Angeles in 1958 was a provincial backwater in the music industry. The music industry had been in New York for 100 years. The only major record company in Los Angeles was Capitol Records, and they were staunchly old-fashioned pop music. Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole. Very successful, but that was it. The rest of the record industry in Los Angeles kind of grew out of the R&B field, which was very thriving in the early 50s there, and were run by small, tiny little independent companies with people with little experience in the music business. So when rock and roll swept through the record business in the late 50s, they had to look to the teenagers to make the music, because the people who owned the record companies didn't know the music, didn't understand the music, didn't even like the music, but that's what was selling. So when kids right out of high school or still in high school, like Jan Barry showed up with tapes, or Phil Spector showed up with tapes at these little, you know, storefront record labels, they got listened to.
So I'm familiar with, you know, Jan and Dean's hits, but I wasn't familiar with how close Jan Barry was to Brian Wilson, or that, you know, Wilson held him in such high regard, especially early on. To me, Jan Barry's story arc is, I think, the most tragic. What do you think about him?
You're so right, Manfred. Most people think of Jan and Dean as Beach Boys imitators.
Yeah.
But it was actually the other way around. Because when Brian's first record came out with the Beach Boys, Surfin', that was kind of a vamp on Baby Talk, which was Jan and Dean's 1959 hit.
Yeah.
And that's not even Jan's first hit. His first hit was with Jan and Arnie, 1958, Jenny Lee. So by the time he and Brian met, Brian had done two maybe three records. And Jan had done a couple dozen. He'd been on the radio many times. Jan and Dean were a very big regional act in Los Angeles. Baby Talk was their only national hit of any significance. But all their other records got on the Los Angeles radio, and they had a style that was drawn from the street corner music we call doo-wop now, that they sort of refashioned in their own vision. And that was the starting point for Brian with Beach Boys music, was to that first record was really a Jan and Dean knockoff. Now, once they met, I mean, they were just collaborators instantly. Jan talked Brian into getting the Beach Boys to back Jan and Dean on some of his songs in the studio for an album. And then Brian showed him part of this song that Jan got finished that became Surf City. And that was the first number one hit out of that crowd. And Brian played on it and sang on it. And Jan showed him how to stack harmony vocals and overdub them in the studio and convinced Brian to use session musicians on Beach Boys records. Yeah, he was very much the mentor and the advanced veteran of the record wars when they met, although Brian obviously became very advanced real quickly, progressed really on his own.
Did you ever have a chance to meet Jan Barry?
Only, of course, after the car crash.
Right.
And he was, you know, severely brain damaged, but very happy. He was back on stage doing Jan and Dean numbers with Dean and a band out of Santa Cruz called Papa Do Run Run.
Right.
And they had specialized in performing surf music at a time when surf music was all but unknown again.
Yeah.
Like early 70s, and they knew all the Jan and Dean some numbers, and they could cover the harmonies, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that Jan didn't really have to be right on the money. And so I went and saw the show for the Chronicle and went backstage and met him, and he was an aphasiac, so he had difficulty communicating, but there was no doubt that he was super happy to be doing what he was doing, super happy to be doing an interview with somebody for the newspaper. It was almost like, you know, a young kid, that kind of enthusiasm.
So my understanding in those later years when they would perform, he had to listen to like cassettes of their songs before going on each performance so that it would sort of reinforce the lyrics. So, you know, when he would perform, because he would forget them very easily. But my understanding is that after the accident, I mean, there are a couple of other Jan and Dean records that came out. He also did some kind of psychedelic album, if I'm remembering right. I mean, how involved was he with those productions a year or so after the...
I think the Jan and Dean records after the accident are largely the work of Dean. Jan had a couple of records that Lou Adler, who started in his career as manager of Jan and Dean, put out on his Ode label. And they were kind of awkward, but, you know, you could tell that he wanted to do this, and Lou was backing his play on it. He was not beyond mocking himself on shows in that period of time. You know, the standard riff when he was performing Dead Man's Curve was when he got to the part where he goes into the recitation. "Well, Doc, you know, the last thing I remember." And then he would just go silent and hang his head. And the audience would go, "Whoa, whoa, what's going on?" And then he'd snap to at the point and go, "Dead Man's Curve." You know, it's like, so he was not beyond making fun of himself. But he got into drugs. He got into money problems. Everything that could happen to a brain damaged former rock and roll star happened to him.
Well, let's talk about Dean for a second. I know that Dean Torrance still lives in Huntington Beach. For certain, I know that he lobbied elected officials down there to nickname the town Surf City. Talked about the song. We mentioned it briefly already. It was their biggest hit, their only number one. But Dean does not actually sing on it, right?
That's right. No, everybody sings on it but Dean. Brian Wilson, Jan, a couple of guys from University High, a couple of Latino guys that they knew during high school who performed under the name The Gents. They're on it. But no, Dean wasn't on it. And Dean also fixed up the lyrics. Brian had this Two Girls for Every Boy, and Jan sort of fixed that up. And they handed it over to Roger Christian, who's a disc jockey and songwriter, very interested in car songs. He was a car guy, not a surf guy. So when he was done, Dean had to sort of bring in the surf element. Like Dean was the one who said, put the Woody without the rear window in the lyrics, right?
Yeah.
And neither Dean nor Roger Christian feature in the credits to the songwriting. That song is credited to Jan and Brian. So, it was a fast and loose time. The creative energies were flowing, and whose photo got pinned to the board and didn't, so sort of matter of chance at times.
Well, it seems like Dean, with his relationship with Jan, that guy put up with a lot. What's your take on Dean?
It was in his character. Dean was one of those California guys. The term came to be applied to him was laid back.
Yeah.
He was a passive personality. He was perfectly capable of taking the sort of abrasive, controlling relationship that Jan had, because Jan was smart enough and creative enough to make money, and Dean could get a new Corvette every year. All he had to do was go along with Jan. And I mean, they had their fights and everything, but Dean definitely knew who the genius was, and it wasn't him.
So during this whole Frank Sinatra Jr. kidnapping, it's Dean who was giving the kidnapper, fellow University High alum Barry Keenan, the seed money for the plot, or, you know, giving him some money, at least, and the thing gets started. I'm just so amazed that did not completely sink his and Jan's career.
I do not understand why Dean Torrance was not indicted with the other kidnappers. He not only financed it, he rented a safe deposit box with Barry Keenan, in which Keenan stowed a lot of the important evidence for the kidnapping. He lied about it. His involvement the first time he was on the stand, he had to come back and correct all his. So why Dean wasn't he, if that had happened today, he would be indicted as a conspirator. And I can't explain why he wasn't back then. Just Hollywood takes care of its own.
Well, I guess so, because I was thinking too that Frank allowed their career to continue, and that he didn't work behind the scenes to sort of sabotage those guys. I guess let's bygones be bygones, and he seems to be an okay kid. You know, he went to high school with my daughter, and I guess it's all right.
I have no idea. It's just an amazing episode, an extraordinary story. Talk about the gang that couldn't shoot straight. What a bunch of goofballs. And they screwed it up as badly as it could be. I mean, Sinatra offered them $1 million, and they only wanted $200,000. You know, I mean, it's just insanely goofy. And the final sort of analysis of it was supplied by one of the co-conspirators, a guy named Joe Amsler, who also went to University High. And he told Joe Gibson, Jan's girlfriend, when she visited him in jail, that nobody will ever know what really happened. And I think that's the truth.
Ladies and gentlemen, the original Surfer Stomp. 1, 2, 3, 4.
We mentioned, or you mentioned, Bruce Johnston a moment ago, and to me, I see him as kind of being this linchpin between most of the characters and the artists in the book, from Jan and Dean, the Beach Boys, Kim Fowley. Also, he seems like the least known, most important player or musician in the book to me. What do you think?
Bruce is the secret hero of Hollywood Eden, and isn't it amazing to discover how far back and how significant his contributions were to Los Angeles rock and roll, right from the very beginning of Jan Barry's Garage. When he joined the Beach Boys in 1965, he was already one of the major figures on the scene. He'd played piano on so many hit records. He'd produced hit records. He'd sang on hit records. He'd written hit records. You know, and the Beach Boys, well, he's the most trained and skilled musician in the band. He could read music, he could play music, and, you know, he's always just been treated like the new guy, the add-on to the thing. He's not even included in their Rock and Roll Hall of Fame membership. Isn't that outrageous?
That is bizarre. I mean, especially now, because, I mean, I knew that he had worked with Terry Melcher, but your book, you know, describes him in high school, as you mentioned, with Jan Barry, and it's just hustling from the very beginning. He forms this band, the Sleepwalkers, and they're, you know, they're trying to land recording deals, and they're always working gigs. I mean, like, from the get-go, this guy has got a hand, and as you said, he becomes a producer, and he's working with all kinds of artists, does an early surf record as well. Anyway, he gets my vote for the guy with the most unrecognized early, most unrecognized influence early on.
Mine too. I mean, you know, he was still in high school when he was leading the house band at the El Monte Legion Stadium and backing up every rock and roll act that came through that summer of 58. And Richie Valens was on the show every week. So, I mean, that's the entire history of rock and roll in one man's career.
Well, hey, so I want you to recount this one story where it's kind of interesting to me. He's like the new guy. He's perceived as still, you know, sort of the new guy in the Beach Boys, but he's the one they send overseas to the UK with a copy of Pet Sounds to sort of promote the record over there. I mean, they think pretty highly of the Beach Boys over there and kind of show them around. What exactly is that story?
That's a fantastic story. And Kim Fowley too, Kim Fowley is a high school friend of all these people, or at least associate. Maybe Bruce Johnson was the only guy that liked Kim Fowley, but they all knew him. And Kim Fowley's in England, and he sets up all these meetings for Bruce, and Bruce comes over there, and Keith Moon of The Who makes him his new best friend because he turns out to be a big surf music fan. And one night, Bruce gets back to his hotel. Fowley is in the lobby just waiting for him. He goes, "Come on, we got to go upstairs." Upstairs waiting to hear these Pet Sounds test pressings that he bought and had been playing for everybody all week was Paul McCartney and John Lennon. And they listened to the entire album through, and then they listened to it a second time, and then they goofed around on the piano he had in his hotel suite, and then they went off to Paul's place and wrote Here, There, and Everywhere for the Revolver album, which they were working on at the time. So yeah, this was a big scene, you know, like Pet Sounds album had been born in Brian's desire to make a record as great as Rubber Soul. It was a kind of unspoken competition, and Bruce just delivered the goods and played it right there for McCartney and Lennon, who were blown away, as everybody was who heard that record.
There's a man in the funny papers, we all know. I'm glad you mentioned Fowley now, because I wanted to talk about him a little bit. You know, there are a fair amount of rogues in the story. I think it's fair to call him first among equals, or is that too harsh?
Fowley was just a creep in those days. He graduated from that status as the Svengali and producer and manager of the Runaways when he raped Jackie Fox the first night she was in the band. So, no, he's scum and always has been. But, you know, he had a very difficult upbringing. He was kind of tragically abused by real Hollywood family. His dad was in 100 movies, but you never heard of him. His mother was in a bunch of movies, but she's got out early and married well. That's another Hollywood strategy. And both the parents ignored him as much as they could. So he was just sort of this, like, you know, abused, creepy guy who had been attracted to the world of rock and roll, where they have always had tolerance for aberrant behavior. And Fowley's an interesting Hollywood case. I mean, he has no apparent talent, couldn't sing, couldn't play an instrument, couldn't write, couldn't produce records, but he could do enough that if he found somebody that could do those things, he could co-produce, co-write. It's so Hollywood. And, he never had any really big successes, but not since Hollywood Argyles and Alley Oop in 1960, but he had often enough success to stay in the game and keep his fingers in. And then there's this whole Kim Fowley versus Lou Adler dialectic that goes on in Hollywood Eden, because Adler just couldn't stand the guy and, you know, went out of his way to make Fowley's life miserable, including stealing the mamas and papas from him.
And in a sense, there was also sort of a Jan and Dean thing there too, where Fowley thought that he was not a controlling interest, but he was the gateway for Adler to come into contact with Jan and Dean. And then in his mind, you know, Lou Adler stole Jan and Dean from him. But specifically, you have a line in there, quote, "Fowley needed to have enemies to justify his poisonous worldview." And so Lou Adler is kind of the number one foil to him, right?
Voodoo doll. Yeah. You know, and Lou Adler made him angry all his life, and Adler just, you know, turned around and tortured him. It's a classic Hollywood dialogue.
Well, just to give it a sense too about Fowley, and You know, not only is it he's got this kind of music sort of thing, he's always hustling, but he just seems to somehow be able to convince people to do things that are just the wackiest. Like there's a story you have about he somehow is able to get himself over to England because he's taking this young girl. He promises the mother that he can introduce this girl to royalty or to someone of noble lineage and get her married off somehow. What is this story?
Yeah, and the gal brings her boyfriend too, and you know he's living in a hotel suite, and when mom finally shows up, you know the game's over. But he's in England and on the streets, and he gets involved in writing songs and working for publishers, and undoubtedly exaggerated his Hollywood record company experience. Hooked up with Andrew Lou Goldham, who was managing and producing the Rolling Stones at that time, and you know he got his way around. DJ Proby was somebody he knew from Los Angeles who had turned up in London and was sort of a minor, kind of like an Elvis right. type. And so he latched on to Proby, and you know he had a couple of stays in England, sort of you know working his way through the London music business in the same side of peripheral, marginal way that he did in Hollywood.
Far away in Africa. They all come from near and far. Rock all night and never stop. Dancing to the jungle hop.
You know, my favorite minor character in the story is, I guess, Kip Tyler. I think Jungle Hop is really great, and She's My Witch, both those songs you mentioned. Also, there's like an, I think it was unreleased at the time, Whale Man Whale, which I think is a really cool track. Now, at some point, this guy's got both Bruce Johnston and drummer Sandy Nelson in his band. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Well, first he had a band that was based around Fairfax High saxophone player named Steve Douglas.
Okay.
And Steve had another high school buddy named Larry Nechtel in the band and a drummer named Mike Bermani. And when Duane Eddy hit in 1958 with Rebel Rouser, he needed a band, and he just hired that band away from Kip Tyler. They didn't need the guitar player, so the guitar player stayed behind, and Tyler hired the Sleepwalkers out of University High, which was Sandy Nelson on drums, Bruce Johnston on piano, and a guy named Dave Shostak on saxophone. And they'd been playing together for a number of years, and they became the new Kip Tyler and the Flips, who were the house band in 1958 at the El Monte Legion Stadium.
Yeah. But now Johnston, Bruce Johnston actually refers to Tyler as a creep. And yet it's Tyler that inadvertently winds up helping Sandy Nelson with the big hit Teen Beat. Isn't it something about they're working on beats and Tyler shows up and he's like, hey, you know, that's the sound right there, buddy. He starts dancing around and they decide, yeah, we're going to build the song around this.
Tyler glommed onto Sandy as a kind of manager. And when Sandy's record Teen Beat hit the charts in 1959, Tyler realized that there wasn't a contract with Art LeBeau, whose record company put it out. And he went and cut a deal for Sandy at Imperial Records. And that included him getting a little bit of a record deal, too. So he got Sandy on Imperial Records, where Sandy was quite successful, had a series of well-selling albums and another big hit. And, you know, it was kind of one of the engines of that label. Kip Tyler's Imperial single, nobody even remembers.
Why did Johnston refer to Tyler as a creep? What was creepy about him?
He was older. He wasn't really a rock and roll guy. He was just trying to ride the whole thing into some kind of show business career. He was sort of bossy. He didn't really know much. He didn't have the smarts or the sensibility. So, you know, Johnston realized that he wasn't going to get anywhere and that they had to lose Kip Tyler if they were going somewhere. And they did lose Kip Tyler. And Johnston went off and made records with the band that didn't happen. But, you know, it was just all part of the road. It was like this guy Kip Tyler had a little bit of a boost up for these guys. He was the first band leader that got them any kind of prominence, but real quickly they ran through him. He was just a Hollywood hustler.
So along comes Dick Dale, and the surf music begins, and it really takes the Beach Boys to, you know, carry it to a national level. How do you put it? Hodad Brian Wilson is the guy who intuitively grasps the metaphor inside surfing. So, Joel, what is the metaphor inside surfing?
Well, it's the celebration of the rugged individualist and the conquering of adversity over and over again in the case of waves, right? Each wave is another piece of adversity. And there's a sense of freedom and liberation that's associated with that. And that's all the metaphor that's inside surfing that resonated once that idea of surfing spread beyond that little piece of California coast. On the California coast, the people that were engaged in the sport tended to be very unconventional nonconformists. In a sense, they were the parallel of the beatniks up in San Francisco. They were more athletic. They were outdoors. But it was that same kind of rejection of conventional society and embracing of a different and new set of values. And so that also is packed into that whole thing about surfing. It came with a haircut. You had to dye your hair blonde. It came with an outfit. You could wear Bermuda shorts and Madras shirts, and it had a sound. And those are the sort of components that floated together to create this national fascination with something that just doesn't make any sense. I mean, why were people in Iowa buying Beach Boys records and wearing shorts? You know, it was like this California thing just caught everybody's imagination.
You mentioned Capitol Records signing Dick Dale in 63, and they pay like $50,000 to sign him, biggest amount since Elvis had been signed back in the 50s. They already had the Beach Boys at that point, right? So why such a huge amount for Dale?
Dick had an album called Surfer's Choice on his own label that had been the best-selling album at Wallach's Music City in Hollywood, at Hollywood and Vine, for a year and a half. And the Capitol Records building was about three blocks from that record store. So there was no shortage of Capitol Records people being made aware that Dick Dale had this huge record, much bigger than the Beach Boys' little radio hits at that point. They'd had a couple of radio hits and they'd spread out a little bit from Los Angeles, but Dick Dale looked like he was the godhead of surf music at that point.
Hey, little Cobra, don't you know you're going to shut them down?
We spoke of, talked about Bruce Johnston, and I think we mentioned already he worked with Terry Melcher, Melcher the son of Doris Day, who would also go on to produce The Byrds and Paul Revere and the Raiders. He worked with Bruce Johnston as Bruce and Terry, and together they produced the Ripcords. And there was one thing that I wasn't quite, didn't quite understand. So you make a point in the book to say that at first the two did not hit it off. But what was it that brought those two guys together?
Terry Melcher was signed to Columbia Records first as an artist, as a singer. And he quickly decided that he wanted to work behind the scenes. Since his mother was such an esteemed artist on the label and a big stockholder, he was sort of pushed into a training program. Now, also keep in mind that at that point, 1962, Columbia Records was cold as ice on the pop charts. I mean, they had Johnny Mathis and they had Andy Williams and all that old square stuff, but they weren't getting on the radio and they weren't getting hits up the on the top 40. So they brought this young guy in thinking maybe he could solve that. And the first thing he went to work on was trying to pick up on this new surf thing that was happening in Los Angeles. And Bruce Johnston had a very large Los Angeles radio hit called Do the Surfer Stomp. Now, at that point, Terry wanted Bruce Johnston on Columbia Records and signed him. They did a record called Surfing Round the World. But in doing that, they fell into a partnership, a collaboration. And Bruce really brought Terry out of his shell, really showed him how to sing, really clicked with him as a harmony vocalist. They clicked as partners, as friends, as collaborators. Mm-hmm. And in no time, Bruce was working at Columbia Records in the office with Terry. They were doing A&R out of the Sunset Boulevard Columbia Records West Coast office, which was a very remote outpost of the Columbia operation.
Well, the last thing I remember, Doc, I started to swerve, and then I saw the Jag slide into the curve. I know I'll never forget that horrible sight. I guess I found out for myself that everyone was right.
So surf music comes to prominence, and then let's say it hasn't completely waned, but there's another sort of California homegrown type of rock and roll that's coming out of the Car and Hot Rod theme tunes. Can you recount how Dead Man's Curve is actually related to a moped?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Brian. What was the song?
Artie Cornfield.
Yeah, Artie Cornfield was an East Coast songwriter out of the Brill Building, 1650 Broadway, and the Screen Gems guys had sent him out to work with Jan Barry, and he and Brian got into a crash on a moped. They were wearing short pants, so it was a little more bloody than it would have otherwise been. They got some scratched up legs, but that just said song to Artie Cornfield. And Roger Christian, the king of the car song lyrics, he'd already come up with this title, Dead Man's Curve, taken from a well-known stretch on Sunset Boulevard, where the street takes a nasty curve turn. Mm-hmm. And in fact, voiceover artist Mel Blanc, you know, Porky Pig and all those, he'd been in a near fatal crash just a couple years before at that exact intersection. So it was a well-known place and it had that name. And the Cornfield picked up on it, and he and Brian started this thing. When Jan saw it, he recognized what was in there, and he brought that thing out. Original version that appears on the Jan and Gene album was not what you heard. He kept working on it after it was released as an album track, overdubbing different parts and editing it until he had this kind of masterpiece AM radio single.
So the Roger Christian, I've been fascinated with this guy because I don't seem to find out a lot about him outside of he was a DJ in the LA area in the 60s. You know, he supplied these car lyrics. I read someplace, maybe on just Wikipedia, about that he actually used to be a car driver, car racer. Well, what else did you happen to dig up on this guy for your research?
Well, Christian was somebody that was brought into the Beach Boys realm very early on. Murray Wilson, Brian's dad and the manager of the Beach Boys, had met him. He was the one that really initiated the Beach Boys car songs. 409 was on the flip side of Surf and Safari. So right from the very beginning, the Beach Boys combined these car songs with the surf songs. And again, across the country, the car song thing just resonated. Cars was such an essential element of the Los Angeles landscape. Those kids at University High, they drove themselves to high school in their own cars. That wasn't something that was commonplace outside of, you know, the upper middle class of Southern California. So the whole car thing was something that was romanticized for teenagers who often really didn't have any other place where they could be themselves than in a car. That was the place where they could be free from adult supervision and enact their own dramas, either in the front seat, the back seat, or wherever they were going. And so that was a super important element of this emerging picture of teenage life in California. And Roger Christian was that was his thing. He was a car racer. He always had hot rods. He was very much into that whole hot rod culture, which is another aspect of Southern California culture. You know, going back to Big Daddy Ed Roth and right. George Barris, who did all the movie cars. I mean, he was making hot rods in North Hollywood Garage in 1945.
So, in fact, I don't want to digress, but I will say I did get to meet Barris once, and a friend had just said, yeah, just go by the shop, you know, they'll take you around if you ask. And so I had a friend of mine from out of town, and we went down there, and we said, yeah, you know, a buddy said we could just come by and look at the cars if that's cool. And because the shop is ongoing, it was a work, you know, they were working, and they said, yeah, sure, take a stroll around. And we got to sit in the real Batmobile, and Barris came in and took a picture of us sitting in the Batmobile together. You know, I mean, it was like sort of a dumbstruck moment where, you know, afterwards you think of all the things you like to have asked them, you know, but in the moment you're just kind of like, oh, I can't believe we're sitting here together.
Ah, what an amazing experience, Manfred. I mean, really, don't you think George Barris should be recognized as this great American folk artist?
Well, yeah. I mean, and also Big Daddy Roth and these, I can't think of the other detail, Von Dutch. I mean, there's all they all contribute to this homegrown American artistry, especially, you know, when our fascination with cars and that ties back into Southern California too, right?
And it fanned out into the fine art world down there. It was a very porous culture. There were not the sort of like discrete compartments that had been developed over the years in the East Coast, where there was a definite hierarchy in the art world and the entertainment world. But in Southern California, the hierarchy was not so clearly defined. And so there was this real fluid exchange. A lot of the young artists in Los Angeles were surfers or hot rod nuts. And the hot rod finish, all that extensive overpainting and baking, that worked its way into the fine arts field with the fetish finish guys. There's so much of that in Southern California in the early 60s of everything, film, music, art, sports, all just sort of blending together.
You know, the other main bad boy of this California 60s scene, I mean, I'm thinking of Phil Spector being that role, and bad in terms of being, you know, a very difficult person. He moves back to L.A. in 65, and my understanding is that's because, you know, he'd been recording here still off and on, but he moves back to L.A. in 65 because by this point, L.A. or Hollywood is like eclipsed New York, and London is sort of a center of pop music. But it seems like the problem that he's having with, similar to Jan Berry at the time, is that the pop music world, though the epicenter may be have moved to Southern California, it's actually also moved beyond those two guys. You know, the music scene's changing, the music is changing, and those guys are desperately trying to stay with it, but, you know, it's evading their grasp.
Pop obsolescence, yes. Spector was struggling with that when he moved back. But keep in mind that that's also when he had his very biggest record, You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling by the Righteous Brothers. Okay. So he was at the top of his game and then suddenly didn't know what to do. Eventually, he was able to produce the greatest masterpiece of his career, River Deep Mountain High by Ike and Tina. And it was so roundly rejected by the public in this country that he pretty much retired just right then and there, just closed up shop and hid out in his mansion, staying up all night playing pool.
Now, it was, that part I had already known, but just several years ago, I hadn't even realized that he had a hand in producing, you know, working with the Beatles later on. But, you know, that when he's working with them, that's not the same thing as when he is back in the 60s and seems to really be dominant over all the aspects of the production. You know, no one is going to challenge him when he wants to do something a certain way or like poor Tina, make her do all those takes over and over and over again when she's standing there in her bra, you know, sweating.
Well, the difference between the work he did with the Beatles and George Harrison and Derek and the Dominoes and all those guys, he wasn't the artist on those records. He was the producer. On the other records that you're talking about, the Crystals and the Ronettes, those people were the singers, but those were Phil Spector's records. He was the artist. So that was the huge difference. And it was his artistic vision that failed with River Deep Mountain High. And, you know, he never recaptured that. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over
and over and over again, my friend. So this mid-60s period in L.A., we've got the Byrds, the Mamas and the Papas have coming with this sort of ascendancy of folk rock, which the Beach Boys have at their roots, I think, at least with like Al Jardine, you know, who'd wanted them to be a folk group a bit when they were beginning. And certainly there was a folk music scene in Southern California in the late 50s forward, but it doesn't really seem to overlap very much with the rock and roll scene as the rock and roll scene developed. Is that true?
I think you're right about that. For some reason, the Beach Boys covering a song they learned from the Kingston Trio, Sloop John B, didn't register as folk rock at all. But Mr. Tambourine Man by the Byrds, which again, Terry Melcher was always the Beach Boys were his template, right? Yeah. And when the Byrds came into the studio with Mr. Tambourine Man, he made them slow the tempo down until it matched the tempo of Don't Worry Baby by the Beach Boys. I mean, it's always the Beach Boys for Melcher. But so these things mixed together. But no, the folk rock wasn't a part of that. I think that, you know, it really enters most strongly right at that stage where Mr. Tambourine Man was the sudden number one hit, and P.F. Sloan and Barry McGuire had that Eve of Destruction number one hit, and the group that became called the Mamas and Papas come to town. And that's where the sort of folk rock thing, you know, blew up.
Well, you know, I just got a couple more questions here, and I don't want to give P.F. Sloan the short shrift or anything. So let me ask you about him real quick. So he's working with, I believe, Steve Barry still at this point, and they're writing tunes, but it's this Lou Adler giving him the Bob Dylan album that inspires him to come up with Eve of Destruction, has a big big impact on him. Which Dylan album was it that Highway 61 or
the Bringing It All Back Home?
Bringing It All Back Home.
Yeah, that was the first folk rock Dylan album with Like a Rolling Stone on it, and it was Like a Rolling Stone that blew Sloan's mind, and he wrote five songs that night, one of which was Eve of Destruction. They didn't think Eve of Destruction was going to be the single. When they went into the studio, they had other songs that they were much more interested in, and they only cut Eve of Destruction because there was a few minutes left at the end of the session. And they didn't have time for a second take. McGuire was a little unhappy with his vocal, but they didn't think anything of it. And then the promo guy for the label picked up an acetate over the weekend and played it for a radio station program director, who told him he was going to slam it starting Monday morning if there were records in the market.
That's a great story. There's something about Lou Adler. Does he see Barry McGuire somewhere at a club dancing around leading a conga line? And he's like, who is that guy?
Talking to Terry Melcher.
Yeah, oh, Terry Melcher sees him. Okay.
Well, everybody knew Barry McGuire because he was the lead vocalist and rather memorable lead vocalist with that gravelly voice of the new Christy Minstrels hit Green Green. So, you know, he had like a folk hit, and he was a voice that was recognized. And when he was all hippied out and on drugs, leading a conga line through this scene at the Birds, And Adler says, who's that? And Melcher says, oh, it's Barry McGuire. Adler goes, oh, that guy. So he brings him over to his record company where he's got Sloan and Barry working as a songwriters. And they're turning out these kind of Elvis imitations for a Canadian singer named Terry Black. And he says, you know, go see what Phil's got. And McGuire liked some of the Phil stuff. And they went in the studio and did them. And Eve of Destruction was sort of like an afterthought on that.
So the end of the book, the last couple of pages, you're focusing on Jan Barry's recovery, the difficulties he's having. Finally, you wind it up when he has a run-in with a songwriter, former Arwen Records A&R man, Joe Lubin. Now, from that point forward, was his recovery, you know, accelerated? I mean, was he got much better after that, or as good as he was going to get?
I think he improved, and he certainly adjusted to life as someone with brain damage. I chose to end the book at that moment with a kind of ambiguous note about that. I mean, really, does it matter that he was able to continue? I mean, his life was ruined. He'd been an Adonis. He'd been a godlike figure. And now he was just this crushed guy who couldn't even recognize himself in old videotapes, right?
Well,
It's such a
not.
Total.
I mean, this was that weird moment where, you know, Dick Clark wants to see the light in his eyes. Maybe it was present, maybe not. But then he was able to, when Joe Lubin said, you know, as you related, something to the effect of, you know, hey, Jan, how's it going? And he's like, oh, hey, Joe, as though nothing had actually happened. And Lubin at first, I guess, maybe isn't even aware how terrible the accident had been for him.
Yeah, Joe Lubin had no idea how bad Jan was off. He saw him in a restaurant and walks over and says, hi, Jan. And Jan looks up and says, hi, Joe. And he's with a caretaker who just like, what? And just heads for the payphone to call Jan's doctor. This is a breakthrough moment, as far as she can tell.
Yeah.
And then Joe brings his wife over and says, and you remember my wife? And Jan says, sure. Now, whether he does or not, we don't know.
Yeah.
That's that. I just wanted it to like sit there, because anything further than that is just not going to tell any story.
Well, and the other way I interpreted it too was you're kind of closing the circle on the story. You know, Lubin was there at the very
beginning,
and here's a moment where he comes back to him. You know, as you said, I mean, he's left with the scars and the recovery going forward, so that his story, as far as having this impact on popular music, is ended, you know, kind of bookends things, to me at least.
That was my plan. Yeah, you know,
it worked.
I had to face some resistance from an editor, an excellent editor. He did a wonderful job on the book, and he really got under the hood. And he argued very strongly for an additional chapter, kind of a where are they now, to sort of bring everybody up, you know. And I just didn't want to do it. I thought, no, man, the story is over now. It doesn't really matter what happens to Brian. It doesn't matter what happens to Jan. The greatest work they've done is behind them. It's all over. What the movement they started has been launched, and their parts in it are now going to be by the side of the road. That's how the book closes. And I didn't see any purpose to like going on about, you know, well, Brian finally discovered psychotropic medicine and was able to perform his songs back in the end of the 20th century. And, you know,
Well, I think that's the right call. I mean, we now have a thing called the internet and Wikipedia. I mean, if anyone has an interest as to whatever else happened, then they can look that up. But the story has been told. And something else here about Brian Wilson, to me, it's like, unlike Jan Barry or Phil Spector, although Wilson's also under enormous pressure, he's able to rise to the challenge of the, you know, the changing music tastes that are going on through the course of the mid-60s, and that Good Vibrations being that pinnacle. But it leaves him remarking to his girlfriend, I think your quote is, he says, "The problem is, I don't know whether I should be saying hello to everyone or whether it's time to say goodbye."
Isn't that a remarkable final benediction from Brian? Because, you know, you're right. He did reach that pinnacle with Good Vibrations, just barely, right? Just barely, but he did. And after that, you know, he's never done anything that's on that level.
I mean, they were still working on things. But yeah, I see his things started getting more and more out of control.
There were no more masterpieces from Brian after Good Vibrations. You know, he would come back and do a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit here and a little bit there over the years. But yeah, that was it for the pinnacle of the Beach Boys oeuvre. And in fact, it could be the pinnacle of the whole pop music movement. I don't know that there's a greater record in pop music history.
So the greatest record in pop music history is one of the only ones I can think of that uses a theremin, and it's not like some spooky noise.
How brilliant was that? I mean, it just ties that whole record together. And he was working on that theremin part right up to the last hours of that record's production.
Oh, really? Yeah. Well, I mean, that's Good Vibrations. I mean, you hear that weird noise in there, and that is the sound of, you know, as a vibration. I mean, intuitively, like, well, that's it. That's the vibration.
Yep. You're right. Absolutely.
Well, Joel, it's time for us to say goodbye. And I want to thank you again so much for joining me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Thanks for being such a great reader, Manfred.
Well, thanks for being such a great writer and author, Joel.
Well, let's do this again and give my best to our pal Steve.
I sure will. I've been speaking with author Joel Selvin about his latest book, Hollywood Eden, Electric Guitars, Fast Cars, and the Myth of the California Paradise, which is available from fine booksellers everywhere. And right now we'll take in some of those good vibrations, courtesy of the Beach Boys, here in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
Good vibrations from the Beach Boys here for us in Little Steven's Underground Garage. I'm the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to author Joel Selvin for joining me today to talk about his book, Hollywood Eden, Electric Guitars, Fast Cars, and the Myth of the California Paradise. Thanks also to Olivia Callahan for producing our podcast. And for our next episode, I'll be joined by Hope, the lead singer in the Norwegian all-female rock band, The Cocktail Slippers. That's your next Coolest Conversations podcast, presented by Hard Rock in Little Steven's Underground Garage.
As a child, Otha Ellis Bates McDaniel taught himself to play guitar, but he never found one he liked, so he built his own. Soon after, his rectangular-shaped axe with an old TV dial for a volume knob could be heard on radios everywhere as he launched the beat heard round the world. He was Bo Diddley. His handmade guitar is at the Hard Rock Cafe, Times Square. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history are at Hard Rock Cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.
Don't let it slide, baby, diamond ring.